From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. In the 1960s, the writer George Plimpton pitched to some Major League All-Stars, tried out as an NFL quarterback, sparred with the great boxer Archie Moore, and then wrote about it. And ever since, writers have been taking up a whole range of athletic pursuits for the experience and for the material. Well, Joshua Foer presents us with an interesting variation on that theme. His book, Moonwalking with Einstein, describes his brief but rather successful career as a mental athlete. Moonwalking with Einstein is about the art and science of memory. Joshua Foer, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
I should say first that while most practitioners of athletic participatory journalism discover that the gap between the competitive elite and the eager reporter is a vast chasm, you actually achieved great heights in the U.S. Memory Championships.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly didn't expect the story would end up where it did. I should, I suppose, begin by explaining that there is a rather bizarre contest that's held every spring called the United States Memory Championship, in which people get together and try to see who can remember the most random numbers, the most lines of poetry, the most shuffled decks of playing cards. And I had shown up at that contest as a science journalist, basically expecting to find, I don't know, what I thought would be the Super Bowl of savants. Mm-hmm. But as I talked to the competitors, I discovered something rather different, which was these guys were not savants. They didn't have photographic memories. Rather, they had trained their memories. And they said, anybody could do it. And I said, anybody? And they said, yeah, you know, even you, we could teach you.
And well, you went into training.
Yeah, I came under the influence of a guy named Ed Cook, who has one of the best trained memories in the world. And I spent the better part of a year training my memory, also trying to understand how memory works, why it sometimes fails us, what its potential might be.
All of which brings me to the cover art of your book and the title, Moonwalking with Einstein, which is displayed over the image of a some rooms, in two cases connected by stairs. One of them is sort of a bathing beauty sitting on the floor. Another one has a sumo wrestler. Another one, there's a nurse with a monkey hanging from the ceiling. And I'd like you to explain the significance of that sort of what seems like utterly random image.
Well, the title itself, Moonwalking with Einstein, mm-hmm. actually references a memory device that I used while training my memory. The image, Einstein moonwalking, is kind of goofy. And the fact that it's goofy is part of what makes it memorable.
Is he walking around like Michael Jackson, or is he on the moon?
I'm imagining him with the white glove, but I suppose you could conjure up any image that you wanted.
Okay.
But the idea is that an image that is so unlike any other image that you've ever thought of is one that's more likely to stick in your mind.
So we can attach things that we want to remember to these vivid images that we can summon to memory.
Yeah, that's exactly how it works. It's a kind of code.
Some of the devices that you describe are really quite old. And I'd like you to talk about the memory palace for a moment, how it works, and who came up with the idea.
Sure. Most of the techniques that are used in one of these memory competitions goes back to ancient Greece. These are the same techniques that in the Middle Ages scholars used to memorize entire books. And they all more or less come down to the notion that as bad as we are at remembering a poem or a phone number, we're really good at remembering certain kinds of visual and spatial information. And so the idea behind these memory techniques that are used in these competitions is to transform the kind of information we're not very good at remembering into the kinds of visual spatial memory that our minds are actually built for.
So I learn to visualize in my mind, say, a house or my own home, someplace I'm very familiar with. And as I'm trying to remember numbers or images that have nothing whatever to do with my house, I mentally park them in places, associate them with very vivid images that I have in my mind, put one in the mailbox, you know, one in the sink and all that, and go around my house doing this.
That's actually a terrific description of how a memory palace works. The idea is when you walk back through that space, if you've done it correctly, you'll see the images that you left behind when you were initially remembering that information.
Well, after a year of preparation, working out, improving your memory, you go to the U.S. Memory Championships. What was it like?
Well, a memory contest is a bit like the SATs. It's a lot of people sitting around at desks, scribbling away answers furiously and then handing them in at the front of the room. It's not quite as sexy as a spelling bee, but it's definitely got its drama.
Queen of Hearts.
Queen of Hearts is the correct second card.
Nine of Clubs.
There is the third card.
King of Hearts.
There is the fourth card.
King Diamond.
We have our new national memory champion is now Josh Flohr. Congratulations.
You actually won the U.S. Memory Championship.
Having entered it as this experiment in participatory journalism, the experiment sort of went awry.
And you achieved, for example, a breakthrough in terms of being able to memorize a deck of cards.
Ultimately, I set a new U.S. record in that event, in the card memorization event, which I really hadn't expected. I think that record has subsequently fallen, though.
But you have to tell us what your record was.
At the time, it was a minute and 40 seconds.
You have to explain what you did in the minute and 40 seconds.
Sure. In a minute and 40 seconds, I remembered the order of a shuffled deck of playing cards and then recalled it within 5 minutes. Now, the best guys in the world can do this in under 30 seconds, which sounds almost extraterrestrial and is really something to behold.
Now, since that time, do you continue to practice? Do you continue to work out and try to memorize the odd license plate that goes by, or are you out of shape?
Oh, I'm a fat schlub at this point. I basically hung up my cleats after after winning that contest. It was sort of an experiment in participatory journalism, and I got my answer. The sad truth is I still forget where I parked my car all the time. I still forget why it was that I opened the refrigerator door. I still forget to put down the toilet seat.
And yet those are visual experiences that we think might imprint a little bit more easily.
You'd think so. The thing about these techniques is they only work if you remember to use them. That's sort of the funny thing. You've got to remember to remember.
Well, Joshua Flohr, thank you very much for talking to us about the book. The book is Moonwalking with Einstein, The Art and Science of Remembering Everything.
All Things Considered is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. To find out more about the books and authors you hear on NPR's programs, go to npr.org/books. There you'll find author interviews, NPR's bestseller lists, and find out what our staff is reading. This is NPR.
This time of year, when big league baseball players have reported to training camps in Florida or Arizona, there's often a story that goes like this. 36-year-old pitcher, never played in the big leagues, gets a break in spring training, makes big impression. Will this season be a dream come true? Well, here's the twist this spring. There is a 36-year-old pitcher who over the years has competed not just in the U.S., but also in Venezuela, Canada, Japan, Hong Kong, Australia, and whose big break came Monday, throwing batting practice for the Cleveland Indians. And it is historic because the pitcher is Justine Siegel, no relation. Now, Justine Siegel joins us now from Phoenix. Hi, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
And do we have it right? Do we think you are the first woman to ever pitch batting practice in spring training?
Yeah, I think that's what we know of.
And you pitched against Cleveland this week, but also against Oakland today.
Yeah, just got off the field throwing to the A's. And that was a fantastic experience as well.
Yeah, how did it go?
It went well. I was less nervous than the Indians, so that was good. But I throw a four-seam fastball, and I want the ball to come in true and firm and over the plate and let these guys work on their swing.
Apart from the fact that everybody would want to be in spring training right now, at least everyone I know, what's in it for you? Why do you want to pitch batting practice this spring?
Well, first, pitching batting practice is a dream come true for me. I had the idea when I was 17 years old and I was watching the Indians hit BP and I was thinking, I want to be a BP pitcher. The other part is just to create a dialogue about girls and women in baseball. 40% of Major League Baseball fans are women and 100,000 girls are playing youth baseball across the country. So there's no reason why there can't be a female BP coach.
Now, you are pursuing your Ph.D. in sports psychology at Springfield College. You've been an assistant coach there for the men's baseball team. You've obviously spent a lot of time with male baseball players. How do the men down in Arizona, how are they treating you when you walk out to the mound?
Well, the players from the Indians and the A's have been nothing but respectful. You know, the Indians and the A's, they believe in this dream that I have, and they've supported it all the way through.
Now, well, that's great. Now, over the past couple of days, have you thrown a batting practice to some major leaguers whose names we would all recognize?
Well, I just got done throwing to Coco Crisp.
Coco Crisp, now with the A's, but he played for the Boston Red Sox not too long ago.
Yes. He was fun to throw to because he was giving a little smack, having a little dialogue with me as he was hitting. He was having a good time, and it made me smile and have a good time as well.
Here's the big question. How realistic is it to think that sometime in our lifetimes there might be a woman throwing not just BP in spring training, but pitching for a major league ball club? What do you think?
I think it's really realistic to see a woman pitching in the major leagues baseball if she's a knuckleball pitcher, particularly a left-handed knuckleball pitcher, just to throw one more loop in there.
That woman could throw in the major leagues, you think?
Yeah, I would put my money on that.
Justine Siegel, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
That's Justine Siegel, batting practice pitcher for the Cleveland Indians and the Oakland Athletics, speaking to us from spring training in Phoenix, Arizona.
More coming up on All Things Considered. When people return to work after being unemployed for a long stretch, their new job often is not as good as the one they lost. That's just one of the difficult realities faced by the people we're profiling as part of our Road Back to Work series. For the next year, we're following 6 unemployed people in St. Louis, and we've given them recording equipment to document their job search. Today, NPR's Tamara Keith updates us on 3 of our job seekers.
When we first met Randy Howland, he had been out of work for more than a year.
It's Thursday, January 6th. It's in the morning. You know, one advantage that Lisa has, my wife, is that me being out of work, I get to make breakfast for her.
Howland's career peaked back in 2002. He was making more than $100,000 a year, working for the telecom giant WorldCom. Then the company went bust. He's held a series of lower-wage jobs since then. Even though Howland is 50 years old and has a master's degree, the jobs he's been applying for most recently have been entry-level positions in sales and customer service.
If I'm not bringing in the bacon, so to speak, I better make some bacon.
Howland has applied for more than 600 jobs in the last year. And finally, in the dead of winter, there's an opportunity, an actual job offer. It's not perfect. It's a call center type position where he'd take customer service calls from home. The pay is low. With taxes taken out, it's less than Howland was getting on unemployment.
This is Randy. It's Thursday, February 3rd. Tomorrow I start my new job. My salary will be an exciting $10 an hour. It's 1/5 of where I was at my peak. Of course, it's better than where I was when I was 21. Again, I'm 50. We'll see.
In the job, he's doing customer service for a telecommunications company. He's back in the industry where he once thrived. And that makes him happy, even if the pay hurts his pride.
It's time. I've been sucking government money for quite a bit. So I'm sucking it up, and with my wife's income as a hairdresser, we can barely wing it, but I think we can do it.
He's settling for less, and he's not alone.
Hello, this is Jennifer and Brian together. It is Tuesday, January 25th. It's 5:30 p.m.
Jennifer and Brian Barfield are newlyweds. She's 47, he's 53. They met at a networking group for unemployed people in St. Louis. Brian spent his career in manufacturing. Jennifer is an IT professional.
Brian today had to take a test for a particular job that he had applied for. And I'm going to hand this over to Brian and let him talk about how it went. So here you go, honey.
I took my time with the answers and got them correct. And I end up passing the test with flying colors. I go back next week for a interview with the plant manager and the department managers to see if or where they'll put me in the plant.
It's a warehouse position at a major St. Louis company. It's a weekend job, just part-time, and he wouldn't be a manager, so a step down from his last job.
Hello. It is late Wednesday night, early Thursday morning. It's about 1 o'clock in the morning on February 3rd. We're up here. My lovely wife is ironing my shirt, getting ready for my interview first thing in the morning.
This may not be his dream job, but the Barfields need the income.
So I assume if everything goes well tomorrow, they'll have assigned me a department. If everything doesn't go well, I guess I come home without that job.
And he really wants that job.
It's Friday, February 4th. And I just got a call, and I have been accepted. It's 2 days a week, but it's way more than unemployment is, and it's a chance to get on permanent.
He'll continue applying for full-time positions at other companies, too, hoping someday to work two jobs. According to government data, more than 8 million Americans are working part-time now, but want to have full-time jobs. But at least they have jobs. Brian's wife, Jennifer, is nearing 2 years of being unemployed.
Hi, this is Jennifer. It is February 7th at 12:22 a.m. Well, I've had a bad day. The day started off for me with a message from a recruiter about a job that I had interviewed for last week that they said on the voicemail that the company just passed on me and didn't give any feedback as to why.
It was her third rejection in 2 days. She still has a few irons in the fire, as she calls them, but they seem to be going cold. Even with Brian's new job, money is tight.
It's just our situation. It's so frustrating to me. And right now I'm so down. I'm just questioning everything from spiritual issues to what's the point of, you know, living life if this is all it is. And no, I'm not suicidal or anything like that. But I'm just really frustrated.
For Jennifer, Brian, Randy, and so many others, life after a job loss isn't what it was before. There's a new normal, and the adjustment hurts. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
And for more on the Road Back to Work series, visit npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
A wooden sled called
Rosebud.
A weapon to vanquish a villain.
Father's lightsaber.
Property masters help design them. And most often, property masters track props down and stand by through the shoot in case something else is needed. Prepping for Oscar night this coming Sunday, NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg learned what it takes to prop a film.
On the set of The Muppets, a Disney film due out Thanksgiving, property master Trish Gallagher-Glenn has provided a telephone for Kermit the Frog, but not a very old typewriter on Kermit's desk.
This actually is set decorating. The set decorator does all of the furnishings, all of the draperies, the paintings, the furniture, and the prop master does the things the actors actually pick up and touch.
So, guns, gavels, globes, a giraffe even, if an actor pats it, those are props. Trish Gallagher-Glenn has to find more than 1,000 props for the Muppet movie. Her toughest challenge was on the film Charlie Wilson's War. Tom Hanks as the Texas congressman lobbying for various covert CIA capers. Charlie had to read the Washington Post the morning the Twin Towers were attacked.
No one had the pre-crash paper for September 11th, 2001. The Washington Post did not have it. As it turned out, one of the women who worked in Charlie's congressional office Her husband was a writer for the Washington Post and happened to have a story on the front page of the paper that day, and he loaned it to us.
And because it's movie land and in Hollywood, making the day means meeting deadlines and budgets and time constraints, the newspaper scene was cut from the film.
Here's a good one. Here's a good one.
Props come from many sources. A prop house called History for Hire specializes in vintage stuff, all kinds of stuff.
Ambulance gurneys, amputation kits, anchors, anvils, aprons, archaeological equipment.
Jim Elyea owns History for Hire. Jim knows his history and his inventory. He knows that diaper pins from the 1940s are on a second shelf lower left.
Yeah, I like that one.
Propmaster Hope Parrish needs pins and toys for the film Water for Elephants.
I might want to get like a little stiff bear.
Let me talk you out of the second one because that's the 50s snout.
Okay.
Hope leaves her order and hurries off for more props, all for additional photography for Water for Elephants. The main filming was done last spring. Now, what if History for Hire has rented out that table that you used in the first shoot?
My brown hair goes gray. I'm up 24/7 to figure out how to fix it.
Hope's grandfather was a property master, so was her father, Dennis. He propped for Hello, Dolly, Patton, Rambo, and The Aviator. He and Hope worked together on that one.
If you want to give me your email address, I can take a picture of it and send it over to you.
Dennis Parrish started this L.A. house, the Hand Prop Room. Dennis stocked it with movie stuff, as well as a library full of research books, encyclopedias, Civil War histories, and the property master's Bible.
The Sears catalog, because if you open the Sears catalog in 1925 to a page where there's eyeglasses, those are the eyeglasses people were buying.
Hope did major research for The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. The film spanned almost 100 years, from 1911 to 2005.
Finding 9 eras of props for the house, for the cars, the license plates on the cars. Every year that we changed, 30, 40 cars had to have the plates changed. I think I spent probably close to $50,000 to $70,000 in license plates.
Are you keeping the Halliburton case?
Yes. You can walk through the ages in a prop house. Hope Parrish, a third-generation property master, practically toddled through history growing up on movies. Female prop masters were rare when Hope started working. Her dad told her she would need a powerful whistle to do the job.
Oh, you don't even want to hear it. I'll blow you out of the room.
There's a naked lady in your hall.
Yeah, we like that.
The naked lady is a mannequin at ISS Prop House, where we meet another third-generation prop family. Bill Petrotta's dad, Vic, propped at Universal, MGM, Paramount, urged his son Bill not to go into the business. Bill, however, did. Props for Close Encounters, Edward Scissorhands. Bill schlepped his son Drew around on weekends hunting for props.
Saturday night, I was about 12 years old.
Early 80s, 70s or something like that. Shopping for crazy stuff for like a Cheech and Chong movie.
Being 12 and going to a head shop on Santa Monica Boulevard on a Saturday night.
Him and his cousin are going like, what are we doing in here, you know?
Drew got addicted to the work. Right now, Drew is propping The Avengers. Dad Bill, who's 67, only works as an assistant now. Too stressful otherwise.
You never know what's going to come up. The directors go to sleep at night and they dream all night long. And in the morning they wake up and they go, you know, it would be nice if we could have a girl coming out of a cake. And then they look at you and you just say, how much time do I have?
And then what do?
You run like hell.
Bill Petrotta did Jaws with Steven Spielberg. You know that 1975 movie about the mean fish that made mincemeat out of its victims? Director Spielberg was young, 29, brilliant, and made demands.
Tomorrow when we do the arm, he says, I want some crabs. And like there's crabs crawling through the seaweed onto this arm. So it was in April in Martha's Vineyard, and it was colder than you know what. So I got the crabs. Steve's going, they're just standing there. And I said, what do you want them to do? He says, I want some movement. I said, fine. I walked over and I got a cup of coffee. And I said, is your camera ready, sir? And he'd go, yeah, it's ready. And I threw the coffee on him. These crabs were running now. Hot coffee on him.
Oh, Jesus.
He just looked at me and said, cut, that's good.
A script might just say he goes fishing. The rest is up to a property master. Get the pole, the boat, the bait, the crabs, get the crabs to dance, whatever it takes, which often can be everything to make the day, the movie, the magic. In California, I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
And you can take a tour of a movie prop house and check out everything from blow dryers to baby carriages at NPR.org. Susan's Hollywood Job Series continues tomorrow when she goes on the road with a location scout. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montagne. The BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico has served as a huge experiment. It has allowed scientists to see what oil does to the plants and animals that live in the Gulf, from seagrasses to turtles to giant bluefin tuna. But many of those scientists say their work is being held up. And as NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, science delayed, maybe science denied.
After the spill, scientists swarmed over the Gulf like mosquitoes at a summer garden party. Mostly, they looked for bodies, birds, fish, turtles. Universities footed the bill, and the National Science Foundation provided about $20 million for research. The Interior Department and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration sent experts, too. But the real gumshoe work is just beginning. Will wetlands recover? Were tiny fish eggs and larvae wiped out? Will surviving animals reproduce?
It's a huge challenge.
Christopher Dahlia runs the School of the Coast and Environment at Louisiana State University.
You know, in the military talks about the fog of war. In this particular case, we're dealing with sort of a fog of research.
In the military, there are generals, but not in ecological research. Stan Senner is with the environmental group, the Ocean Conservancy.
There really isn't anyone in charge.
True, the federal government's scientists are doing some research now, but most of that lies beneath a veil laid down by the Oil Pollution Act. The act calls for research in order to assess damages against those responsible for oil spills. Because that may involve litigation, that research is largely secret.
Dozens and dozens of studies are in the field. Thousands and thousands of samples have been gathered. But that work is largely being held confidential.
Eventually, that scientific data should become public. But Senner and other scientists worry that in the meantime, gaps in the research may go unnoticed without peer review from the larger scientific community. Senner, who worked on the Exxon Valdez spill in Alaska, says secrecy sows doubt among the public.
We saw repeatedly in the case of the Exxon Valdez that the people who are most affected by the spill, if they didn't have information, it tended to feed their worst fears.
There is some money for independent open research, the $20 million from the National Science Foundation, for example, but that money runs out soon. And Christopher Dahlia points out that now is a bad time for research money to dry up.
We're going to have an interesting time in the springtime because we're about to come into the season when life starts teeming in the coastal waters. So one of the big issues that I'm concerned about is what's going to happen to the food chains, the food webs, off the coast of Louisiana in particular, where the oiling was the heaviest.
Ironically, it's BP that has spent the most for independent open research. Shortly after the spill, BP gave several universities and research groups in the Gulf about $50 million, with the promise of another $450 million over 10 years. BP and the Gulf states picked a board of scientists to decide who gets the money. Rita Colwell, a life scientist at the University of Maryland, is head of the board.
We are gathering the data to be published in the open literature, and anybody can use it. Private individuals, BP, federal government, anyone.
But the other $450 million that BP promised has not materialized. Colwell says recruiting the research board and writing ethical rules for research took a long time. The board still has not published guidelines for how to apply for money, so it could be months before scientists see any of that $450 million. And that worries scientists like Don Bosch, who sits on the official oil spill commission that's investigating the event. He says the slow start has already compromised the research effort.
Because we had much more limited effort to go out and actually describe the effects of the spill and track the oil when it was actually coming out of the bottom of the Gulf.
Scientists say they need to be out in the Gulf now, and they need someone to organize all independent research going on. They cite the case of herring in Alaska's Prince William Sound. 4 years after the Exxon Valdez spill, scientists thought the population had recovered, but they failed to read all the signs. The population crashed and has never recovered. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Remember cassettes? They gave a lot of people their first chance to carry around and record music, or anything else for that matter. From mixtapes to kids' violin lessons to early hip-hop releases, cassettes were a cheap way to capture and circulate sonic expression. Well, here's some good news for those of you waxing nostalgic right now. Cassettes have not gone away. For the latest in our series on formats, NPR's Neda Ulaby explores today's cassette tape culture.
An out-of-business East Los Angeles bar. There's a clubhouse for lovers of experimental media and music.
There we go. That's a tape sound.
It's called Dublab. It's an artistic collective. Today, their project is an internet broadcast of DJs playing cassettes.
This is Top Tape, a special magnetic music broadcast for your ears. Matthew David is first up on deck.
When he's not DJing, Matthew David runs a micro label. It's called Leaving Records, part of a small but enthusiastic community of people releasing new music on cassette.
This is actually something I recorded yesterday in Topanga Canyon with a friend to tape.
To tape, but why?
It's the most accessible, easiest, cheapest way for anyone to record a piece of audio.
Okay, it's democratic, and it's do-it-yourself. Anyone can do it, including a pair of 22-year-olds who founded their own tiny tape label a year ago. It's called Kill Hurt. Its roster is 5 bands. That includes Cowabunga Babes from Austin, Texas.
A lot of our friends, when we first started this, and our family too, laughed at us. They thought it was the most hilarious thing. They said cassettes.
But Katrina Boza and her boyfriend, Chris Johnley, say cassettes are the perfect format for the music they like.
Cassettes and punk music and noise music and underground music, they've always had this kind of symbiotic relationship.
Cassette tape is trebly. It favors certain frequencies. But that makes it ideal for certain genres. Garage rock, freak folk, anything that doesn't depend on high fidelity, where tape's inherent trashiness becomes an intentional effect.
Vinyl is really nice and crisp and warm, and digital files are, you know, very clean.
Tape label boss, Katrina Boza.
Cassette, the quality of it degrades over time. It's staticky, it's noisy, but a lot of the bands we're putting out and a lot of bands that are becoming more and more popular in the independent world nowadays are noisy and scratchy.
That's one of Kilhurt's other bands, Pizza. Cassette's hiss and distortion serves its natural nastiness in a good way. Cassettes now are a gatekeeper in the way some labels used to be, for people who like this kind of music and are overwhelmed wading through the options online.
Mainstream act after mainstream act, yeah, indie act after indie act, bigger indie labels, blog, bands.
Chris Johnley works in web development, so he's online all day, every day.
After a while, you're kind of just like, this stinks, you know?
His cassette label brings him out of the virtual world and into clubs to scope out bands. And it compels him to handle actual things, flipping, inserting, rewinding. John Lee's Los Feliz apartment is dominated by technology nearly as old as he is.
These machines are like, they're like printer-sized, big, gray doorstops.
Where did you find them?
On eBay.
eBay. We got a ridiculously good deal.
Yeah, I mean, 20 years ago, it's like $3,500 worth of equipment.
As opposed to the $200 they spent buying their duplicators and decks. Kilhurt sold about 250 cassettes so far and cleared a couple $100.
It's chump change, but,
yeah,
you know, we're going to break even.
Kilhurt sells cassettes with its website, at shows, and through little indie boutiques, including Ooga Booga in L.A.'s Chinatown. It's frequented by August Brown, who covers music for the L.A. Times. He says this city is uniquely suited for a new generation of cassette fans to flourish. After all, he says, if you live in L.A. and you're into cassettes,
you probably also have some terrible 1989 Honda Accord with, you know, non-functioning windows that, you know, happens to have a tape deck.
There's something about L.A.'s car culture that lends itself to cassette culture, particularly for artfully scruffy connoisseurs of cool, Brown says.
There's a certain Los Angeles zen to putting on some massive sun-warped, decayed thing while going to the beach.
The idea that format says something about community has larger implications, says Mark McNeil of Dublab. His creative crew brings together all aspects of cassette culture, recording new music, finding old music, and creating new sounds from old stuff you find.
Oh, man, I got a million dreams.
You have this potential of finding some of the most wild, one-of-a-kind tapes out there. You're finding home recordings of people, demos, amazing, weird hypnosis tapes, people recording lectures, mixtapes.
Mixtapes. Cassette culture refuses to lose what mixtapes represent. A handmade, personalized aesthetic. A talismanic artifact. For the few people still stubbornly making them, cassettes remain a meaningful way to preserve art. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.